You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, November 29th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Quite a show for you today. First up will be Rob Johnson, director of the Project on Global Finance at the Roosevelt Institute, also director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking on the European sovereign debt crisis. Then David Siegel, executive director of Demand Progress, who will tell us about the Stop Online Privacy Act that literally is an existential threat to the internet. And finally, our guy Jeff Smith, giving us an update on what's going on with Occupy Wall Street in New York. The students marched against CUNY last night and at Baruch College in New York City. We'll get an update on that. Of course, also on the program today, the Herman Cain train could have some problems with the track switching mechanism. Or let me put it this way. It may take longer than 30 minutes for the pizza to get there. Or let me put it this way. He may never have to deal with Ubeki-Beki-Beki-Bakistan. Now, a woman comes out, says he's had a 13-year affair with him. I imagine around this point, Herman Cain's wife is saying, okay, let's wrap this thing up now. Now we're cutting into the opportunity you had to host your own show on Fox News. You cannot be the candidate who's had a 13-year affair. That's Newt Gingrich. He's the philanderer. He's got that working for him. You're supposed to have a different hook. So the Cain train, we could be saying goodbye to Herman Cain very soon. Another Bloomberg story comes out yesterday. It was a story that outlined all the Fed discount window deals. Today, a story about how Hank Paulson sort of gave a heads up to some of his former Goldman Sachs buddies. Just want to give you an advance word about what we may be doing as the Treasury Secretary. Maybe, you know, we may be doing stuff with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Not that it would help your hedge funds out, although it would help your hedge funds out. Quite a lunch. And a judge blocks a settlement between the SEC and Citigroup, saying, we got to see what Citigroup did for there to be a settlement here. No more of this repeat offense by Citigroup, and they don't have to claim that they did anything wrong. I think it's time you guys go to trial. That and much more coming up. We got to take a break. When we come back, I'll be talking to Rob Johnson. Just got a lot of news to get to, and, of course, update on my Thanksgiving and all that Coming up in the show, feeling a little better, folks. Not great. But we'll be back in just a moment with Rob Johnson. We are back. Sorry, folks. Some technical difficulties. We'll have to get to Rob Johnson later in the week. So let's get to the story about a federal judge in New York on Monday threw out a settlement between the Securities Exchange Commission and Citigroup over a 2007 mortgage derivatives deal. Now, this is back in 2007. Judge Jed Rakoff basically said this this slap on the wrist, $285 million settlement, is neither fair nor reasonable nor adequate nor in the public interest. Can you imagine the Securities Exchange Commission making a settlement that's neither fair nor reasonable nor adequate nor in the public interest? And he said so because it doesn't provide the court with evidence on which to judge the settlement. In other words, the SEC and Citibank just basically agreed on a number. The SEC doesn't have to present its case to the judge. Now, you can do that between two private entities. If Matt is suing me for back pay or future pay or because I made you, you know, do something that hurt you, made you clean the windows outside the building, and we come to a settlement, judge is going to be like, okay, two private parties. But the SEC, and maybe they needed a reminder of this, is actually working on behalf of the public. And they have simply gotten too cozy with these banks. The ruling could throw the SEC's enforcement efforts into chaos because a majority of the fraud cases and other actions the agency brings against Wall Street firms are settled out of court, most often with the condition that the defendant does not admit that it violated the law, while also promising not to deny it. In other words, we have Citibank repeatedly violating the law, making a promise not to violate the law in the future, breaking that promise, and then rinse and repeat, go in, pay a small fine, and that's the end of the game. And finally, a judge basically said, done. Done with this. He goes on to say in his decision, the SEC of all agencies has a duty inherent in its statutory mission to see that truth emerges. And if it fails to do so, this court must not, in the name of deference or convenience, grant judicial enforcement to the agency's contrivances. That sounds like a judge who's a little bit pissed off and annoyed. Good. Good, I hope he is. He's got every reason to be. Meanwhile, this story is just too hilarious to me. And in one way, I appreciate it. Another way, it's just hilarious BS. This is by Mark Thiessen, who is one of George Bush's former speechwriters. So right there, we could end the conversation and just simply say, this guy's got to be somewhat pathological to even show his face. Never mind his byline. I guess he's an op-ed writer for the Washington Post now. The media is so liberal. You know how that goes. And he writes, the Super Committee's 13th member, Occupy Wall Street. Now, I will say this. I do think he is right in some respects to credit Occupy Wall Street. It's easy to go overboard, But certainly Occupy Wall Street created even more pressure that made it harder for the Democrats, and there were some of them who definitely wanted to on that super committee, to cave and essentially sell off Social Security and Medicare benefits to basically screw the average person in the United States. So without a doubt, Occupy Wall Street deserves some credit from preventing a horrible deal from being made. But that's about it. The interesting thing about this piece is, well, I guess the interesting part isn't about his lying. That's to be expected. He goes on to say, Occupy Wall Street demands that Democrats impose massive tax increases on the wealthiest 1% of the country, is what ultimately did in the super committee. Now, I only wish it were. The only thing that did in the super committee was the absolute refusal of Republicans to raise taxes at all, to create any new revenues at all. We remember the that moment on the debate where all the Republican candidates said, I wouldn't even do a 10-to-1 spending cut to revenue raise, tax increase, which, of course, is absurd. And he wrote, it's not Norquist's pledge that destroyed the super committee. The GOP members of the super committee showed they were willing to violate his anti-tax pledge when they put forward a plan crafted by Senator Pat Toomey that would have raised taxes by $250 billion over 10 years by dramatically reducing the deductions and credits wealthier taxpayers could claim to reduce their tax liability. The GOP plan would have brought in another $40 billion in revenue by using a new measure of inflation to adjust tax brackets each year, which is also a tax increase. So basically, Thiessen is saying the Republicans put nearly $300 billion worth of new taxes on the table. What he's not telling you is that the other part of that deal was, oh, and you know the $3 trillion of taxes that are set to be collected in 2013 when the Bush tax cuts expire? Yeah, that can't happen. So the Republican offer was really a net $2.7 trillion of taxes, or tax cuts, I should say, because they would take that expiration of the Bush tax cuts off the table. So he's lying here. And the most interesting thing about this piece is we are seeing Occupy Wall Street, not just from the Democrats, but also from the Republicans, being pushed into the fulcrum of the debate that could shape the 2012 election. And at a time when even the Manchester Union leader is endorsing Newt Gingrich because Mitt Romney represents the 1%. This seems to me it's going to be a big losing narrative for Republicans. So kudos to Occupy Wall Street. We're going to talk to Jeff Smith more about it later in the program. But still having an amazing impact on the narrative. A stunning one, and it's impressive. We'll talk to Jeff about what's going on specifically in New York in just a moment. But I guess we should get to this Herman Cain thing, right?
We should,
Jeremy. We really should.
We really should.
Because the Cain train is on the move. Let's do this quick because I want to get to David Siegel to talk to us about this Internet Protection Act. But Herman Cain, well, what can I tell you? Last night, a woman basically gave an interview to a local station in Georgia saying that she's had a 13-long year affair off and on with Herman Cain, and that She came out with this because she kept getting inundated by reporter requests and assumed it was going to come out anyways. So Herman Cain went on to CNN yesterday to try and head off this story before it got anywhere. And this is how lame Herman Cain was. I guess it's more like the lame train.
We're back with the breaking news. Herman Cain, Mr. Cain, as you know, we've been talking about this woman who is about to go forward, according to a television station in Atlanta, and say she had, in the words of this television station in Atlanta, a 13-year affair with you. 13-year affair with you. Now, you've been told by this television station that this is coming. You've been discussing it with your lawyer, Lynn Wood, in Atlanta. You're going to issue a formal statement after you hear specifically what she has to say. But did you have a 13-year affair with this woman?
No, I did not.
Did you know her for 13 years?
Yes, but I did not have an affair, okay? And until I see and hear exactly what's going to be, what the accusations are going to be made, let's move on.
Positive.
But I.
In other words, what the lobbyist, Peach Man, Becky Stan man is saying is that I want to be very careful not to deny anything that she's not going to say. If I understood what the parameters of our 13-year relationship were, or rather what she will claim they are, then I would deny it. But I'm not going to deny anything other than just a general denial, because you're not going to catch me in a lie, even though I'm not lying about my 13-year non-relationship with this woman.
I acknowledge that I knew the woman. I acknowledge that I've known her for about that period of time, but the accusation that I had a 13-year affair with her, no.
Do you suspect she has any evidence, emails, letters, gifts, anything that she will be able to bring to try to confirm this?
Woof, no. When you've done nothing wrong, no. I mean, if just like the second woman a few weeks ago came in with this statement, and these so-called documents, which could not stand up to scrutiny, I have no idea what it is that she's going to have to show proof. So until we can't respond to what we don't know.
All right, I want to move on to some other issue.
Of course, that's in fact what he's doing on CNN at that time, responding to what he supposedly doesn't know, but he does really know. Because she had a whole list of phone records of him texting her at all times. Now, look, I do that with a lot of people. I am constantly texting in the morning with women who are not my wife. And, you know, my wife understands that. It's just, this is what I do. This is the way I roll. And just like that second or third woman who accused me of harassment didn't have the documents. She said, there's a chance that this woman who is I've known for 13 years, just coincidentally, also doesn't have the documents that I don't know that she says she doesn't have. And now we're getting reports that Herman Cain is meeting with his close advisors and considering dropping out of the race. In other words, my wife called me and said, okay, Pizza Man has had his fun. Now you're making an ass out of me. I think that's basically what it's come down to. Herman Cain, it was fun knowing you. Let's play it one last time as we go to break.
Herman Cain knows how to solve a problem.
All right, folks, we got to take a break. When we come back, David Siegel, Executive Director of Demand Progress, on this Stop Online Piracy Piracy Act, which is a serious threat to the Internet. We'll be right back.
I can't walk the streets now to calm my mind. your mind.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. On the phone, David Siegel, Executive Director of Demand Progress, to talk to us about the Stop Online Privacy Act, which is actually, that's the Senate version of the bill. Welcome to the program, David.
Hi, thanks for having me on. So the Stop Online Privacy Act is the House version of the bill, and the Protect IP Act is the Senate version of the bill.
Okay, and so... And these two bills, if they pass in each respective house, has one of them passed and the other one not?
No, the Senate version has passed through the Senate Judiciary Committee, and a floor vote is pending, but it's been blocked by a really aggressively progressive move by Ron Wyden, who's put a hold on it. It probably would have passed into law 6 months ago without him there. And the Stop Online Piracy Act, which is the House version, has been heard before committee. It was introduced a couple of weeks ago, and it looks like it's going to come up for committee vote sometime over the course of the next few weeks.
Okay, so just a detailed outline to us what these bills are and why they are so dangerous to the Internet.
So they're slightly different. The House version is a little bit worse in most respects. But the essentials are that it would give the government new powers to block Americans' access to websites that are accused of copyright infringement. It would force search engines to stop listing them in their indices. It might stop people from linking back to such sites. That's true of both bills. And it would force payment processors and advertisers to stop doing business with these sites just in an attempt to put them out of business, without ever having an adversarial hearing before a judge where both sides get to make their cases. Then the House version goes even further by making it a felony to stream certain unlicensed content online with a low and nebulous threshold for who would become an infringer under that. And you could go to jail for up to 5 years. It will also require sites to...
Now, let me ask you about that one in particular. Okay, so I have a blog at majority.fm. Somebody posts a video or let's say somebody posts a video of a band that they bootlegged or whatever it is, I'm liable at that point. Is that right?
Or if it were a karaoke video, if it were a cover band playing, who specifically would be liable is a little bit vague. Part of the problem when we're in this realm, anything that relates to the Internet, in particular the intersection of intellectual property and the Internet, the case law is not very well defined. So there's necessarily a lot of ambiguity until the courts actually start hearing cases. But somebody would most likely be liable, some combination of you and the person who uploaded it. And then under this new legislation, the House side, sites that feed off of user-generated content, be it comments on blogs, be it YouTube with hundreds of thousands of people uploading videos, would have to start policing that content up front. Right now, if something's infringing, they get noticed after the fact and they can take it down and still be in compliance with the law. If the House version passes, they'll have to start parsing through stuff before it's even put online to make sure that they're not that they can't be accused of facilitating infringement in a way that would get them in trouble.
I just turn off my comments.
Yeah, you would probably have to turn off your comments. YouTube's worried they would have to shut down. And Twitter, Facebook, it's the stuff of the web that is the most interesting, the most fun, the sites that facilitate political activism and democratic, small d democratic politics. The meat of the web, what most people use on a regular basis, are precisely the portions of the web that would be under the most dire threat.
How many trillions or billions of dollars are being lost because of this? I mean, I assume this is almost something that is a threat to national security. If it is so important that they're willing to impose that type of draconian restrictions on what's going online, I mean, what is the What exactly is the Senate and the House attempting to save America from?
From a supposed small loss in income to the recording industry, the Motion Picture Association, and so on. Something absolutely dwarfed by the breadth of innovation that's facilitated by the internet, of economic development that's facilitated by an increasingly robust online economy, which would all come under threat if this legislation were to pass, which is why Silicon Valley is finally really waking up to this threat and is actually starting to mobilize their own users, rank-and-file internet users, to contact Congress and ask them to oppose this legislation. I've got to make a pitch quickly for AmericanCensorship.org. Today we're doing a call-in day to Congress, so people can visit AmericanCensorship.org and figure out how to call their senators to ask them to oppose the Senate version, which could very well come up for a vote in the next couple of weeks. And Senator Wyden has promised to filibuster the bill if it hits the floor, and he's going to read off the names of rank-and-file internet users who oppose censorship during his filibuster instead of reading out of the dictionary or whatever a senator usually does. And you can sign up to ask to have your name read into the record at stopcensorship.org.
All right, now, so give me a notion of just how close this is to passage, and what are the dynamics? Like, I know, for instance, I think Al Franken is one of the co-sponsors. Patrick Leahy, one of the sponsors of this bill. These are senators with whom I generally agree with. What are the dynamics here? Is it because Chris Dodd is the lobbyist for Hollywood at this point?
I think that Hollywood exerts a ton of influence there, and if you're a Democrat on the Judiciary Committee on the House side, Senate side, then you tend to see a lot of support from Hollywood, from the content industry in general.
We've lost them, folks. We've got to take a quick break. We'll give a try again. Hold on for 1 second. So, David, I'm sorry. You were saying that Hollywood has a very close connection with the Democrats on the Judiciary Committee, and this is affecting their support of this bill?
Yeah, so Hollywood's been pushing for this bill for a really long time. So is the recording artists, pharmaceutical companies, people who tend to fund campaigns and have a lot of influence over people who are on the Judiciary Committee. And on the Senate side, it's been out there for a long time. The support for it's become pretty entrenched because there wasn't this tremendous popular opposition to it that's come up over the last month or so when it was introduced back a year ago. It would have passed by now on the Senate side if not for Ron Wyden's hold and his threat of filibuster. And we hear that Harry Reid wants to claim some sort of victory on a quote-unquote jobs-related bill, and we're worried he's going to move this to the floor under the guise of being a jobs bill, a bipartisan jobs bill, before the year is out. And so the threat on that side is incredibly present. Threat on the House side is also severe, maybe a little bit less so because it's a newer bill there, and we've gotten some more prominent people on both sides of the aisle to come out against it. Pelosi has made a statement against SOPA last week. Daryl Issa, even Michelle Bachmann have all come out against this. So there's this more interesting, broader array of opposition on the House side, still a big danger, but the Senate is really where we need to focus right now.
So people can go to stopcensorship.org and call their senators and their congresspeople.
There are two different URLs. It's a little bit confusing. Stop Censorship will let you sign up to ask Senator Wyden to read your name as a rank-and-file internet user who's opposed to censorship during his filibuster. And my hope is that when he's on the floor and Patrick Leahy is there, he can read through a list of Patrick Leahy's constituents from Vermont who've asked to have their names read on the floor to demonstrate to Leahy that he's working against the will of his constituents. Same thing for Harry Reid with constituents from Nevada. People can go to AmericanCensorship.org to sign up today to make a phone call to their senators.
It's just stunning and disappointing to see the people who have lined up behind this thing. And then, of course, there's also a tremendous amount of hypocrisy with Republican supporters who, on one hand, will say, oh, you can't have a bill like net neutrality because we can't interfere in the marketplace. Right. But we're perfectly willing to use the U.S. government to put draconian restrictions on the internet to protect the even intellectual property. I mean, we have there's a reason why we have patents in this country, and there's no real indication that anybody's losing any serious amounts of money from this.
No, I mean, the purpose of intellectual property protections is to incentivize the development of new speech, of new invention, and especially when we're talking about movies and music. I mean, anybody who has been paying attention for the last decade or more knows that there is more stuff out there than ever before in the history of humankind. We're not suffering of any dearth of content. But the issue here is that the people who used to control that content are no longer able to pick and choose winners. They're no longer able to make a little bit of money off of everybody new who gets famous, and that makes them really scared. I mean, same reason that they were against cassette recording, same reason they were against home taping of shows on television. Hollywood and the music industry are not good at adapting to new technologies, and if it were up to them, we never would have seen the advancement of VCRs and of cassette tapes. So it's just another moment in that really sad legacy.
Well, Dave Siegel, thank you so much for joining us, Executive Director of Demand Progress. And we have links up to all those sites we talked about at majority.fm. Appreciate the work you're doing.
Thank you very much.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back. We're going to be talking to Jeff Smith, get an update on what's going on with Occupy Wall Street. Back, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Jeff Smith from the Media Center at Occupy Wall Street, obviously also longtime Majority Report listener. How's it going, Jeff?
It's going great, Sam.
I've got that that derivation of Zuccotti lung.
Yeah, it's. I think everyone's got it this season. It got me a couple of weeks ago.
So, all right. So, give us an update. What has been going on over the past week or two that people have been out of Zuccotti Park as of, I guess, the 15th, and tell us what's been happening.
Well, the movement obviously has relocated in since, and so that process was really starting to happen even before the eviction. So there are a number of workspaces where people still congregate. There's the 60 Wall Street space, there's an office space on Broadway, and then also there's places like a community center called Charlotte's Place, which is attached to Trinity Church down there. And so people are continuing to work in the working groups and keep the organization going. And so you still see the direct actions and the different kinds of messaging coming out around different events. But as far as the people that were literally homeless, in a sense, that were living in the park, they've had to figure out, you know, places like various churches around the city, and they've been sort of spread out. And so it's been difficult in that sense, but I think that's just an extension of, you know, some of the troubles we were having acting as a virtual homeless shelter and, you know, outreach for the city anyway in the park. So I would say those aspects have been sort of split, and so there's still an operational team that's working hard to keep people with food and clothing and a roof over their heads. But I think really what you're seeing now in terms of the next stage of the movement is that we continue to still be an amplifier of what's going on out there. And I think even with what you saw yesterday, outside of CUNY, was an event that probably would not have gotten much coverage. And all of a sudden you saw a huge police presence, a huge media presence, and it really amplified the issue. And so that's kind of where I see, you know, Occupy Wall Street really starting to flex his muscles in terms of changing the narrative on all kinds of stories.
There are now 4,800 people have been arrested. There were five Occupy arrests yesterday. This is according to the Occupy arrests Twitter account. What were students marching against CUNY for last night?
There was a board meeting where they decided to increase the tuition, I think $500 a year over the next several years, resulting, I think, in a $1,500 increase by 2015. And so now you're talking about, you know, a city university that was literally tuition-free for over 100 years, from 1874 to 1975. There was no tuition whatsoever. And now they're wanting kids to pay, you know, $6,500 for a year of school. You're talking about, you know, a $25,000+ debt. And, you know, it's just indicative of what's happening all over this country. It's just another way in which the commons are sort of being sold out from the underclass, you know, which is increasingly the 99%. And, you know, another stat that I heard is that, in fact, there are more African-American students that attend CUNY than all of the historically black colleges combined. And so it's such a huge system, and it really serves such a vital role in this city. To see it sort of priced out of the reach of so many kids is really a travesty.
You know, it's interesting to me because I think I've been thinking about the idea of, as we're seeing across the country, city after city evicting or preparing to evict occupiers, and taking away that central location, which, you know, essentially functioned in many respects as a as maintaining very short supply lines, if you will, for movements of direct action. And it seems to me that a lot of the direct action has moved to the college campuses, because you still have students gathering there on a daily basis. Do we expect most of the action to take place on college campuses, at least until the spring? Because I'm also seeing stuff particularly come out of Occupy DC, calls for, if not general strikes, but days of reflection and of staying at home, you know, building up, I think, to what seems to me is, you know, more strike action in the spring.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, certainly could be part of it. But also, I would imagine that at some point you'll see, before the end of the winter, an increasingly a move towards occupying, again, private spaces, but probably indoor spaces, and actually making them public. So whereas Zuccotti was a privately owned public space, I think, you know, the next level is to actually try and liberate certain private spaces and open them up to the public. And really, the model of what happened, I mean, Zuccotti Park was not a particularly great location or, you know, plot of real estate, other than the symbolic value of being near Wall Street. And when you saw what a group of people could inject into that space, and really what was created was so much more than what is left there now, with the gates around it and the security guards, it's really been sort of neutered in a sense. And so I think you could see eventually another space, again, even private or potentially donated in some sense, and that space would be turned into a public space and would again become sort of what I think everyone thought was so great about Zuccotti Park, and what really people still share in all the other Occupy encampments around the country, that collective spirit of, you know, living together and sharing, you know, everything without the need of sort of consumerism And, you know, it really is a in a sense, a way for people to collectively heal their souls.
Excellent. Well, we'll be keeping our eyes open for that. Anything else that we should be aware of in the coming days?
There is a, I believe Obama's going to be in town. There's a defense contractor convention or meeting of some sort, and it's also coincidentally or not also timed with an Obama fundraiser that's going on in the city. So there's going to be direct actions going on with that. That's tomorrow, and I believe there'll be a march from Columbus Circle to where the Obama fundraiser is at 53rd and 7th. And that's going to take place around 5 o'clock p.m. So if people want to join up with that, it's always fun at rush hour at Columbus Circle anyway. But it will no doubt be something to keep an eye on.
Wednesday, 5 p.m. at Columbus Circle. All right. Thanks for the heads up on that, Jeff. We will talk to you again soon. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tim.
All right, folks. Now it is time to head to the better half of the program, wherein I will take your phone calls at 646-257-3920. I will be talking about Alabama's immigration problem. You know, folks, there's nothing more heinous than a white guy getting entrapped in a net designed for brown people. So sad. So sad. Also, speaking about Brown, Senator Brownback. Turns out, he's a real ass. And got it handed to him by an 18-year-old or 17-year-old high school senior. He didn't appreciate it. And I will also read off this email that we received from a libertarian claiming that I was unfair in our phone call debate. I don't buy it, but maybe you will. That and more in the better half of the program. If you want to join us, simply become a member at majority.fm. Also know that we have swag now. Our swag store is active. You can find the link on the top menu bar at majority.fm. If you're buying your holiday gifts through Amazon, do it through our link. All you gotta do is click our link, bookmark it, buy your crap. We get a kickback. And if you're buying anybody or thinking about coffee, tea, or chocolate, I hope you're getting fair trade. Not one that has the exploitation of near slave labor packaged in every bag. You can buy fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate at justcoffee.coop. Get a 10% discount. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. And see you in the better half.